All right.
There you go.
We are here today with Daryl Babak. He is a former chaplain and member of Edmonton Lodge Number 7, Grand Lodge of Alberta. But also, this is a really exciting interview for me because he is an architect. He specializes in historical restoration. But I'm hoping he can talk a lot about that because that's something I really tried to emphasize with this podcast is the importance of our historical and heritage buildings and properties. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Cameron. I appreciate it.
All right. Before we go on to the architectural heritage side of it, tell me about your Masonic journey, because I appreciate what you sent me and I thought it was fascinating. But tell the people about how you became involved in it, kind of where it took you.
I've always been interested in Freemasonry. It seemed like an interesting organization with a lot of ideals and goals that were aligned with where I was going. Although I am Canadian, my dad was a station agent for the Canadian Pacific Railway. I grew up in train stations all over the prairies. My wife is from the Chicago area. I was interested in it. Chicago is a big city for a little prairie boy like me trying to figure out what's what. I discovered there are more Canadians in the St. Andrews Society than the Canadian Club. So I got our daughters interested in Scottish Highland dancing. And I had an original British mini, which they caught on to at the St. Andrews Society and had me organize the vintage British car show at the Highland Games. Suddenly, I'm part of the Highland Games organizing committee. And one of my bucket list items was caber toss. Don't start that in your 50s, whatever you do. But anyway. So I'm on the Highland Games organizing committee. The heavy athletics director actually was worshipful master of his lodge in Wheaton, Illinois. So I asked Jeff about it. Jeff pointed me in a few directions. There really weren't any lodges in my neighborhood. But when we moved back to Alberta, and I'm here in Edmonton, I was living down the street from this beautiful old building that had a sign out front that said Edmonton Freemasons Hall. So I started to ask around. And yeah, I became a Mason. I started out in Canadian Rite at Acacia Lodge Number 11, which is in the Strathcona neighborhood in Edmonton on the south side of the river. It's a Canadian Rite lodge, but there were a couple times when I was invited to attend some meetings of Edmonton Lodge Number 7, which is a York Rite lodge. And what I really found fascinating about York Rite, it's a lot more work, but it's very explanatory and has a lot of great stories to it. So although I was chaplain at Acacia Lodge, I wound up going over to Edmonton Lodge. I was junior steward, but my business just got to be very busy. So I stepped back from the chairs, but I'm still on the education committee and I put together a lot of programs like this.
My dad was a mechanic with CN for forever. So that,
oh,
that kind of
hold cool. It against you. Don't worry.
Well, you know, we'll get past it. But it's always neat, the connections, and also your connection to Chicago. I've been lucky enough to visit Chicago pretty frequently, and I appreciate it. I'm going to include a link in the comments. You sent me some links about Masonic buildings in Chicago.
Yep.
The good and the not so good. The sadder parts of some of the buildings going to disrepair, but other temples going well.
It happens. So as an architect, I restore old buildings. And a lot of that is coming from my interest in history, architectural history, and the history of the skyscraper. Many claim that the skyscraper was invented in Chicago. A lot of great old buildings in Chicago. I still hang out with all of my historian buddies on Zoom links and whatnot, looking at skyscraper history in Chicago. Chicago is a city that grew very quickly at a time when Freemasonry may have been at its zenith. And I think at one point, 1 in 12 men in the Chicago area were Freemasons. So there were all sorts of great Masonic buildings being built. One of the tallest buildings in the world for a couple of weeks anyway was the Freemasons Hall down in the Loop, which unfortunately was torn down some years ago. It was a 23-floor building, if you can imagine that. There are many other buildings in the Chicago area that were Freemasons' lodges. Some are still there. As lodges shrank Many found these buildings expensive to maintain, so they moved away. They're great auditoriums, so some have been taken over by churches. I can think of one on North Damon Avenue, 3900 block, that was turned into loft apartments. So all sorts of different things going on. It's unfortunate. Freemasonry was such a cornerstone of that particular time in history, realizing that there are many times in history by many other groups before and after, but it was such a tremendous influence on our cities, both Chicago, Windsor, Edmonton, all over North America, that it's a shame to see these symbols of influence go away. These are very prestigious buildings. They say a lot about what we were as a society, what we are as a society, our values, the idea that a well-built building is a lot like a well-built man.
That's very good. And now that's a very Masonic analogy, right? That's something that comes up in our degrees. The idea of the metaphor between building yourself in a moral way and building a building in a true way. We're getting a bit of static. I think your microphone is bumping up against your bow tie on your...
I'll hold it up.
There we go.
Okay. Okay.
That is something I think really worth exploring, and kind of how I came in contact with you. I was attending the National Trust APT Joint Conference, which was discussing heritage buildings, their preservation and restoration and promotion of them. When you became involved in Freemasonry, at that time, you were already involved in architecture, right? You already had your firm.
Yes. Yes.
So from a coming into Freemasonry and the buildings, how much of it struck you from an architectural perspective? Like, did you see a connection there right away? Was it something you were excited to explore?
So Acacia Lodge is in Acacia Hall, as I mentioned, south side of the river in Edmonton, Strathcona. Edmonton Lodge number 7 is in Freemasons Hall downtown, north of the river. They're buildings that were both built in 1929, both solid masonry buildings. Acacia Lodge is a smaller building than Freemasons Hall downtown. The sort of brickwork, the sort of stonework, the sort of meticulous care that I saw being invested in those buildings made a lot of sense as a Mason. Interesting part about both of those buildings, they both have a substantial amount of brick, and all of that brick came from the J.B. Little Brickyard in Edmonton. The Little family, for at least 4 generations, were all Masons. The Little family actually was very active in Edmonton Lodge 7. So it was a family of Masons who were responsible for building this town.
It's amazing that even just the materials perspective is not something I ever really thought of until I started doing this research. I mean, you look at Detroit Masonic Temple right across the river. They had connections to Indiana limestone. Mm-hmm. They bought part of the quarry to guarantee, you know, shipment of the limestone. They needed so much of it. The limestone mortar that's used for so many of these buildings, just the raw materials and the connections that Masonic temples had in ordering them, really building an economy in terms of these materials.
So I'm not about to reveal any Masonic secrets, but certainly in our study of geometry, you can see that study of geometry relates directly to how a Mason would lay out a building, to see that corners are square, to see that things are plumb. Again, to properly construct a building, a proper building. You certainly saw many of those items between both the buildings here in Edmonton, between Acacia and Freemasons Hall downtown.
Now you, when you sent me those links, particularly about Chicago Masonic buildings, there was obviously it was great to see Jefferson Park Masonic Temple, which I visited many times, still going strong, but also, you know, you use the word heartbreaking, and I would agree, seeing the south side
Masonic Temple. Yeah.
So, well, talk about that a little bit. really why it's so heartbreaking from a not only a Masonic perspective, but an architectural or heritage perspective.
You know, I have many clients that are not-for-profit organizations that own real estate. So it's easy to lump Freemasons into that. These days, it's very difficult for a not-for-profit organization to hold on to a building like that. Masonic temples were built at a time when we were used to having manual labor who could do a lot of things. We really don't do that these days. And they had tremendous detail. Downtown at Freemasons Hall, we still have some of the original drawings signed by the architect, William Blakey, of the furniture, the fixtures inside that building. And those are all details that you would never see these days in a building being constructed. So for the amount of effort that went into it, for the amount of effort and money finances, it's really heartbreaking to see it all go away. So again, taking that idea of charitable organizations that own real estate, I think one of the presentations that you would have seen at the National Trust Conference was from a program the National Trust of Canada has called Regeneration Works, which is about churches. Canada at this point has 27,000 buildings of faith. However, it's seen that probably by the year 2030, 2040, only half of all Canadians may have any kind of religious affiliation whatsoever. What happens to those buildings that were built as cornerstones of our neighborhoods? So you could say the very same thing about Masonic halls, Masonic lodges, because we were the cornerstone of many different communities in the communities where you find our lodges. What is that saying about where our society is going? What is that saying about what we value in our built environment?
And one thing that concerns me is with, you know, current circumstances, so many of these cornerstone buildings, whether they be churches, Masonic temples, mosques, community centers, were, and in the case of Ontario, in many cases still are sitting empty while we wait for ready to return. And one thing that struck me at the conference was, you know, the danger of a building being underused. If a building is not being used to its full potential, that can lead to increased deterioration and costs. So one thing I'm concerned about, I don't know if you have any thoughts or ways to touch on this, is even before current circumstances, so often it feels like these heritage buildings are not used to their full potential, are often... So,
definitely. Go back to that original comment that I made about 12% of all men in Chicago being Freemasons. And I think that ratio is probably something that you would find here in Canadian cities as well. So when that building was built, and I can certainly speak to Freemasons Hall here in Edmonton, we had enough Masons in Edmonton to keep that building busy and being filled with people for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And all of a sudden, we're not having that sort of traffic now. So in terms of funding to try to maintain the building, simply to keep it heated and to keep the plumbing going, that's quite an expense, especially if it's not being used. I often liken it to, not that long ago, you would find seasonal ice cream stands like Dairy Queen's. That would be these walk-up stores that were only open during summer. And you wonder, you know, if they're only open 3 or 4 months of the year, how can they afford to keep property taxes over 12 months of the year? I think the very same issue is hitting a lot of our civic buildings, like Masonic halls, that were built for organizations that are charitable. Many of those organizations, we used to network and meet people differently than we do now. We used to meet people in our neighborhoods because we lived closer in, because we tended to walk. We didn't have as many cars. These days, people are living further and further away from these centers. An excellent example, which I sent on to you, is the former Chicago Athletic Association. It was opened in 1893. It was a group of very well-to-do, wealthy Chicagoans to engage in sportsmanship and athleticism. which was quite the rage at that point. And at one point, they had a 10-year waiting list to join. But as television became suddenly a method of spending spare time, as we started to live in the suburbs further and further away, it was more difficult to pop in and be part of that club, which was basically your identity. And the very same thing could be said about Freemasons.
What type of ideas do you have, not only as a Mason, but as somebody who specializes in, you know, heritage restoration and preservation, to deal with these challenges? Just the percentages, you're absolutely yep. right. When Windsor Masonic Temple was built, it was 1921. I think it was a year after. So by 1922, Masonry in Ontario reached over 100,000 members. And in the States, the stats you showed about Chicago are in line with my research. In the States, one out of every 11 adult men were Masons. Now, just like you mentioned in Alberta, membership is dropping. So what are some solutions you have for concerns about, you know, Masonic temples being underutilized or dealing with costs, things of that nature? Certainly the National Trust Program, I've looked into it. It's a great program. Yep. I'm going to be forwarding information to our board.
There you go. We're probably looking at finding ways to use our buildings for non-Masonic uses, to rent them to outside groups. I know that here in Edmonton, everyone thinks, well, gee, we can start holding weddings there. That's a very crowded market in terms of buildings that want to host weddings. But there are many other events outside the Masonic community that you can start renting the building to. When you start thinking of it, there probably are all sorts of Masonic community outreach events that we could host in our buildings, like a Saturday afternoon matinee series for kids. That would be an easy one. But we're going to have to look at new uses other than just lodge meetings and festive boards for our buildings. There may be some consolidation. Yep. Go ahead.
No, keep going. I like what you're saying.
There may be some want for consolidation of facilities. I'd say be very careful about that. These buildings, I think urban growth comes and goes. And certainly the sort of neighborhoods that we're seeing a lot of concentration of growth in these days, not that long ago, those were neighborhoods that were in dire straits. We saw a lot of growth going on in the suburbs. I think that we may be seeing that flip, so that suddenly downtown buildings may suddenly become more, well-built downtown buildings are more attractive. I can think of many Masonic properties that are under stress from property taxes because of condominium developments that put up these huge, enormously scaled condominium developments nearby that drive up property taxes. But that simply goes to show that we're on very, very valuable land. Perhaps there's air rights, perhaps there's ways that former parking lots on buildings could be developed. Perhaps there's even ways of building over top our buildings. Definitely try to keep those buildings. Something that a lot tend to overlook would be the idea of land leases, where if you have a vacant parking lot, let's say, that instead of selling that you lease it in a 99-year lease to a developer who would build whatever there. And I'm no lawyer, so certainly talk to a lawyer about how this should be structured. But finding a way to develop that property, perhaps you could even mix air rights from the lodge building that you're in to preserve that lodge and transfer it to that property so that you could build something larger there, become more attractive. And if it's a lease, that would be some sort of annual income.
I think those are all really cool ideas. I do got you mentioned weddings. I want to give a quick shout out to Joyce. She is our kind of ballroom manager here, and she organizes the weddings on our end. We've had a lot of them over the years. I agree with you. It is a crowded market for weddings, but we're lucky to have several here. And the Saturday matinee idea I thought was really cool. We've had movie nights here for like Christmas and stuff, but never never like a regular thing. But that's a great idea. We have the screen.
So an adjunct organization of Freemasonry, or the Shriners. And one of the Masonic buildings in Chicago is the old Shrine Temple, which got turned into a furniture store, and I think it's begging for a use right now. But the Shrine Circuses used to be held inside auditoriums. They were meant for kids. So when you think of it, if you held that particular theme, what sorts of programs could we hold in an auditorium for children? There's all sorts of ideas. I know that Edmonton Lodge tends to have a couple dinner nights. We have theater nights. We bring in a theater group because we are blessed to have an auditorium with a stage and a sound system. Back in the day, because Freemasons Hall in Edmonton has got a spring-loaded dance floor, yeah, I mean, there would be orchestras and we would have ballroom dancing. So there's all sorts of ideas within the Masonic community that could even perhaps be used to educate members outside of our community about Freemasonry, perhaps get them involved. And other ideas that would be simply outside our community, like the weddings and the kitty matinees.
The one thing I think we sometimes forget about with our Masonic temples, or we don't pay enough attention to, in my opinion, is when we're approaching outside groups or organizations for rental, it's the unique selling features of the building. Because to me, every building will have unique qualities to it. I think sometimes we try to rent out a ballroom, but we forget, it's a ballroom in a historical or heritage building that has memories.
And we've got all sorts of stuff like that. And that's why my practice, me as an architect, I restore old buildings because they have so many great stories behind them. It's a sort of atmosphere that is very lacking, I think, in newer, more modern buildings. So it has all sorts of character to it. It's a fabulous selling point. And history is one of those things that tends to be fairly unique. There was a presentation that I did a while back on Main Street programs, on development in small towns. When I moved back to Alberta, I was quite surprised to see that even in small towns, you were finding chain and franchise stores. So every town could boast that they had a Walmart or a Canadian Tire, but not every town could boast that it had the same Main Street as the town down the road. That's your identity. And again, that town down the road, that's a lot like our Masonic buildings. They are great ways for our civic pride, our civic identity.
And what about, I don't know if this isn't tied directly into heritage or to architecture, but in terms of financial and monetizing things, one area I think we're really missing the boat on throughout, just Masonically with our temples, is the creation of products. So for example, not to even plug, but through Square and Compass, I created a scale model of the Windsor Masonic Temple that you can put in, to me, it just seems sensible that, if they had the ability, every Masonic temple would try to create a scale model of it, even just to give away, if nothing else, to groups that rent a building. If you have a wedding, you can give it to the bride and groom, or you can have Christmas ornaments with a picture of the building or postcards.
The 21st century rendition of what you just said, we're branding our buildings. So you can brand the building and put them on a variety of consumer merchandise, which sometimes work. We don't want to cheapen our image and our brand as Freemasons, however. But no, I mean, there's all sorts of great ideas here. The scale model of the Windsor Temple, I've been mentioning that around here in Edmonton to all my friends who have model railroads, because that would make for a tremendous model railroad set. Here in Edmonton, there are six niches that are empty on the south wall of the building. And this is something that I tried to get going inside the lodges that meet in that building. The statuary was never completed, and we have no idea what that statuary was. So if we were to commission statuary, what would we have? And we had all sorts of great ideas, ideas that would relate directly to Masonic history. We could potentially put a statuary of famous Freemasons from Alberta up there. Peter Lougheed, for example, was a Freemason. although that would kind of freeze it in time. So what, yeah, there's all sorts of great branding, if you will, that you can do around Masonic buildings.
What about, I've heard some ideas, you know, some Masons have suggested, I'm curious what your opinion of it is in Chicago, in Edmonton, in Windsor, you know, Masonic temples were built at a time when Masonry was growing. It was probably, you know, it's usually described as the golden age of Freemasonry. So it was built at a time when Masonry was growing, but was not necessarily reflective of what it had been historically in terms of membership or attendance. I've heard some Masons suggest we should be looking at returning back to thinking about Masonry in, you know, its original form and renting out spaces above taverns and not trying to maintain an architecture or an infrastructure that was built during, you know, the height of Freemasonry. What's your opinion on that?
You know, history has many, many stories to it. We keep going back and forth. I would say in this day and age, what would better attract men to be interested in Freemasonry? Beautiful buildings downtown or renting a room above a pub? And without getting too political, I can think of one example here in Edmonton where I have really been championing Freemasons Hall. It's such a spectacular building in such a prominent location. I think that we were very proud to have built it at the time, and I don't see any reason why we still cannot be proud of that.
I agree. From Windsor, Ontario, Windsor Masonic Temple, it's a beautiful building. It's in a prominent location. It was, you know, it attracted thousands of people to its groundbreaking and its cornerstone ceremony. And I definitely feel the same way. There's so much history and heritage to these buildings. Why would we, you know, the emphasis should be on maintaining them for another 100 years.
For the sort of sacrifices that men made to build those buildings in the first place, I think we owe it to them to maintain them. You know, an example that's crossing my mind here is what used to be the Masonic Temple in Winnipeg. Apparently, it was a building that was actually built by Masons, by Freemasons. It's a beautiful stone building in a location down in the Exchange District in Winnipeg. And unfortunately, it's vacant these days. It was sold at one point in time, lived a life as a restaurant for a few years. It's vacant now. If anyone wants to buy it, it's a tremendous buy. But it was actually built by Masons.
How, you talked about, you know, we owe it to those who came before to maintain the buildings. How concerned are you about, you know, deferred maintenance costs, which is something that came up a lot in the conference?
Very concerned about that. The longer you let something go, the more expensive it's going to be and the larger repair it's going to take in order to fix that. And it may even be, I can think of demolition by neglect, not necessarily Masonic buildings, but I can think of all sorts of historic buildings that I've seen that have simply been let go too long, too far, where the argument is it would take so much money to try to rescue these buildings that it's not worth it. And that's really, again, going back to the amount of effort and time that men put in before us to build these places of civic pride, that would really be a shame. The longer you wait to maintain something, the more expensive it's going to be. And I would say that from a membership standpoint, the more little projects that you can get going, I think the more chances you would have to engage the membership. And this is an argument that I use in many of the not-for-profit organizations that I am involved with. The more that you can find ways to engage your membership, and even if it is to rally around a building to see that it's properly maintained, the more that those members will feel a sense of pride and ownership in that organization and want to become involved.
I can speak to, you guys briefly mentioned here in Windsor, Glenn Teske, Michelle Broussard, they've done some amazing work, you know, using this time to complete a lot of those little projects, like you mentioned. you know, repairing the fence and repainting things and repainting doors and fixing ceilings or the roofs, you know. So they've done an amazing, amazing job with that. But yeah, it's amazing how just the little things add up over time.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that I'm a big fan of, and I don't know how it works in Ontario, but I know here in Alberta, if you have a condominium, the condominium association, every so often, I'm not familiar exactly how this works, but they need to put together a reserve fund study. So what it does is it assesses the condition of the building to forecast what sort of maintenance, repairs, and capital improvements it'll need over the next 5 or 10 years, so they can start budgeting for that. And that tends to be the way that I do assessments on historic buildings as well. Many of those items are small enough where the owner may be able to do them themselves or may be able to carry out through volunteer labor. Some of those you definitely need a professional for. So I would really encourage that sort of approach to do something like a reserve fund study for many heritage buildings like Masonic buildings to budget and come up with an accurate idea of what they are really looking at and budget themselves appropriately. I believe that's one of the tenets of Freemasonry is not to carry debt. That's a great way to do it.
The financial aspect of it is always, it's always such an interesting conversation. I've heard that there's always been debate about dues, right? Much of which will go to the building in which you're located. I've heard brethren argue, you know, lower dues will attract more members. Others argue higher dues makes more sense because you can then invest the money into a building and into projects. Where do you come down on that debate?
You know, if you can use the building properly, it will generate enough funding so that you can do whatever you want with dues. To have cheap dues, I'm not sure if you want to attract new brethren simply because you're a cheap organization to belong to. Again, it gets back to that idea of ownership. So I would say that there's probably many ways that you can find to bring revenue into a building from outside of dues. For dues, that's probably up to individual lodges to figure out how they want to approach that, if they want to have expensive or inexpensive dues. But this is a building. How can you run the building on its own? I can think of, you see this a lot in the States with historic churches because of the separation between church and state. And historic buildings in the States can get funding from the federal government. However, division of church and state, the federal government cannot give money to religious institutions. Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois is a great example. What that congregation did is they spun the building off to a not-for-profit organization that owns the building and it rents it back to the church for $1 a year. And that not-for-profit organization not only is able to take government funding, but that not-for-profit organization is able to raise funds from other sources to look after the building and properly maintain it. Recently just went through a large restoration.
I gotta ask, we're probably gonna put this out, I believe this episode will be released on YouTube November 1st. We'll put the audio out very shortly on all, you know, platforms, iTunes, Spotify, all that jazz. And we'll put out some clips on YouTube on Halloween. And also, we'll put some clips on Patreon, which is a paywall, some exclusive clips for our patron sponsors. But since this is around Halloween time, I got to ask about the ghosts that haunt your, or the ghosts that haunt your temple.
So Acacia Lodge, I mean, some men have had odd experiences in the basement, which isn't quite excavated. I don't know too much about that. But I know that downtown at Freemasons Hall, there's a bunch. There's an abandoned dumbwaiter on the north side of the building that actually has windows in it. And every now and again from outside, you can see a child's face in one of the windows. Apparently, the bathroom faucets, ladies' washroom, and the auditorium on the first floor, in the middle of the night, they'll just suddenly turn off and on, and toilets will flush on their own. No idea what's going on there. A while back, I was doing a series for CBC Edmonton about Edmonton's architectural heritage, and I brought them into Freemasons Hall for the radio spot. We did this on Wednesday. Okay, well, that we did our spot. And later that evening, the cleaning lady was sweeping the stairs, and the building was closed. And suddenly she saw this fellow in a tuxedo walking up the stairs. So she confronted him. What are you doing here? The building's closed. How did you get in? He looked at her and vanished. And that's happened a few times. Wednesday nights in the small mahogany lodge room, as we call it, the secretary's chair, and it's a part of a Masonic lodge, the secretary's desk and chair. When we close up at night, we'll usually push the chair into the desk. It's pretty common come Thursday morning, even though that chair was pushed in on Wednesday night, that chair is up against the wall. It moved on its own. I'm hearing stories that we've had paranormals come through and do photographs and whatnot. I haven't seen any evidence of that, but the story's out there. And yeah, I've seen the chair against the wall myself. I haven't seen this guy in the tuxedo on the stair. We think that he was a secretary for a lodge that met in the 30s.
Any talk amongst your lodges about being part of them? I know different cities, Ottawa has one, Windsor has one. They have those haunted ghost walks, especially around Halloween.
That has not. Again, branding Freemasons Hall, you got to watch how you brand the image. Do you really want to be known as the spooky place, or do you want to be known as a welcoming place? So you got to watch that.
I don't know. You know, we in Windsor had some paranormal investigations in place. There's the ghost stories here, as I think every old building has them. I found that it's not really, there's not really been a negative impact. I think people like the mystery of it. I know last year, we can't do it this year, sadly, but last year we had a great Halloween event here where we had trick-or-treating at the Masonic Temple, so Masons mm-hmm. brought their kids, and they walked through the temple, and certain doors of the building were marked with like a bat, and the kids mm-hmm. would knock on those doors, yell trick-or-treat. A Mason would be behind to give them candy. And then we decorated some of the rooms. Some of the rooms were decorated basically with like a fall motif, pumpkins, yep. and very, welcoming. And then other rooms were decorated with more frightening horror theme.
There's enough
decide what they wanted.
There's enough hocus pocus theories going on about Freemasonry anyway. I just wouldn't want to add to them.
On the other side of it, talking about the welcoming aspect of a Masonic temple. So I'm kind of crazy, so I find scary things welcoming, but I'm weird. Hopefully we'll get him on here on this podcast, but you mentioned a brother of yours is a neuroscientist.
Yep, a neurosurgeon at the University of Alberta. He delivered a talk a little while back that bordered on a field of study called neuroaesthetics, where our brains are actually hardwired to find certain environments, certain images, certain proportions to be pleasing. And this is something that you find between cultures. It's not as though we in Western culture would find something pleasing that someone in another culture would not find pleasing. It's something that is hardwired in our brains, much like psychology, which is what this is all about.
I'd assume that's perhaps an evolutionary byproduct, that when you build something a certain way, it's going to be strong and sturdy, so it's going to protect you, and other things not so much. So you learn what will not fall down in the wind versus what will, type of thing.
Yeah, there have been studies, again, between people of different cultures, showing them different environments and just seeing what sides of your brain will light up. What do you find pleasing and what do you find disturbing? There is a building that I can't mention here in Edmonton that recently opened that a lot of people found very disturbing. I was joking that maybe this is something that we could use as an image in this to see if people genuinely did find it disturbing, or if it's something that is culturally ingrained that you could find it pleasant. I don't know.
That's interesting. I'm curious, you know, before you met the neurosurgeon and before you heard his presentation, just in general, does the ideas that he expressed kind of match up with your experience as an architect in heritage planning? Yeah.
Yep.
So you kind of were aware.
I was aware. So you like your Mason's Hall, you like the building that you meet in, you probably even like the room that your lodge meets in. Have you ever noticed that the proportions of that room in plan meet the golden section?
I have not, but I'll check out the plans. I've seen the blueprints, and I know I like to look at them, but I don't necessarily know why until you talk about things like that.
Yep. And even if you look at the height of it, I'll bet that if you took the golden section one more step, that you would find that the height of that room is probably a proportion you find in the golden section as well.
For all those people listening right now, what is the golden section?
Oh, the golden section is like the Fibonacci series. It's a system of proportions, 1:1, 1:2, 2, and you just keep adding the previous number onto this, and suddenly you get this series of proportions that are very pleasing. You get a spiral, 1:1, 1:2, 2:3, 3:5, 5:8, 8:13, 13:21, keep going on. That's a certain rhythm of proportion. I found that the halls here in Edmonton have that particular proportion. Our building was built in 1929, and the architects were both Masons, so they knew of this. And if you look at the proportion of the end wall, the width of the lodge room versus that height, it also is that same proportion.
This is purely speculation, so I wish you the best of luck. Where do you think that you can also be like Pythagorean's theorem? Where do you think that comes from? Do you think that this is
Of geometry?
Is it? Yeah, that's true. But is it? I'm trying to think of the wording. Do you think like so math in general? But those, do you think it's invented or discovered?
Oh no. If I'm looking at a book, it's across my desk, so I dare not reach up to get it. Beauty, Memory, and Unity by Steve Bass, and he analyzes various classical buildings and looking at their proportions. And that golden section that I just mentioned to you, yeah, you can take that back. I think I may have sent some images to you showing the spiral and how it fits onto that pops up more and more often in classical architecture. I think if you were to look at Arabic architecture, you would also see that same system of proportions come up. If you were to look at Asian architecture, Chinese, Japanese architecture, you'll see that come up. If you were to look at some of the archaeological sites that we see in our indigenous cultures, again, you see the very same series of proportions come up.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by this idea of...
It's on Wikipedia.
So I love the idea of sacred geometry. I've always been fascinated by, I've been watching a podcast by a guy called Lex Friedman, who does a lot of stuff. And he asked that question to somebody, and I thought it was such a neat thing, because in Masonically, I think one of the underlying ideas of Freemasonry is that there's an order to the universe, and that order is expressed via geometry, whether it's Pythagorean's theorem or the Fibonacci sequence. It's this idea that you can understand not just our world, but the whole universe through geometric principles. And that's an example of a orderly, and then some would say a moral universe. I had a guy from NASA on a little while ago with the Euclid mission to discuss that, because Euclid obviously is important for Masonry and for science. I just fascinated by the idea of like where these principles come from. Do they come from, you know, the great architect creating a orderly universe, or are they kind of invented by man to explain what we see.
I would say they come from the great architect inventing the universe.
That's my theory too. It's just such a neat question.
But then I'm an architect, so I'm bound to say that, you know?
Well, you're not the great architect, but I'm sure you're a great architect. Great architect, small g, small a.
There we go. Okay.
Moving off your architectural bona fides for a moment, one other thing I want to mention, I don't know if you have any thoughts about this. One thing that really concerns me with Freemasonry right now, and who knows how long this will last, is really the inability for travel. I always emphasize to new Masons when they join that it's incredibly important to travel regularly to other lodges and visit other Masonic temples.
That's how I came to the York Rite as opposed to the Canadian Rite. Through a lot of Zoom meetings, like what you and I are doing right now, and a lot of lodges are doing this. I know certainly at Edmonton Lodge that we invite others from other lodges to attend our education sessions and to invite our lodge sessions online. Although the depth of knowledge may not be there, there certainly is an incredible breadth. I have seen presentations come, well, you're in Windsor, Ontario, I'm in Edmonton. This would never have happened if we had to meet in a building. I can think of many lodges that are promoting education programs that come from way far away, that come from Masons, from other lodges with different ideas, different perceptions. So although it may not be the sort of experience that we are used to, while we're doing this, make good use of it, because there's an awful lot of information that you can get out there. I know for my own professional continuing education, the Skyscraper Museum in New York City recently had a program about the history of the skyscraper looking back at the 20th century. I would never have been able to have attended that if I would have had to have traveled to New York and spent a couple weeks out there to attend this. But I can watch it from my computer here and I can gain an awful lot of knowledge. There's a lot of people attending it that I really wish that I could schmooze with, which is unfortunate. But I can still get an awful lot of information from the speakers.
So maybe it's about, you know, taking the good from this not so good experience we've had these past few months, which is, you know, learning how to use Zoom and connecting with brethren virtually that you can never connect with in person due to cost and time and the ability to travel. You know, I'm not going to travel to Edmonton necessarily, but I can contact you via Zoom. And yep, keeping that, so even when we return to in-person meetings, we can still augment those in-person meetings with, you know, virtual education and Masonic meetings virtually with, you know, international town halls, things like that. I think, you know, that's a good point. There's always something good to be taken, even from a not-so-good situation.
Oh, exactly. You know, when I first took on the chair of Junior Steward in Edmonton Lodge, I was asked to give a bit of a presentation about myself, give a bit of a biography. And that's something that I mentioned, is that I never want to look at a glass of water as being half empty, because even if it's just a couple drops of water left there, that still is something that I can build with and I can do something with that. I think the very same can be said with Masonry. I was speaking of Freemasons Hall in Edmonton being built in 1929. That's when groundbreaking was, a couple months before the Depression hit. But Freemasonry was seen to be so important by the Brethren at that time that they actually finished the building in 1931, despite the Depression going on.
I read that. It's very impressive. It's funny, you know, Detroit had the same type of problems. They actually started building before Windsor 1920, but it's such a massive building that they never actually managed to complete it all the way. So the pool is not done because the Great Depression hit and a lot of that stuff had to be done.
And the same happened with the Medina Temple in Chicago. Started out as the Medina Athletic Club that the Shriners built. And it opened in 1928, I believe, and the Depression hit. They couldn't afford to maintain it anymore. It's the Intercontinental Hotel these days. And the Detroit Temple is an interesting example because Henry Ford wound up writing a check for that. So it's one person who found value there. Getting back to that previous statement I made about making sure that all of your members can find some sort of way to buy into the organization. An organization is going to be every bit as healthy as its building. And many times I can look at the shape of a building, see what condition it's in, and that's a good reflection of the sort of condition that its organization is in as well. A well-run organization is probably going to have a well-run building, just like a well-run building shows that there is a well-run organization behind it. So instead of having one person cut a big check for everything, everyone needs to get involved. Everybody needs to be part of this.
Do you think that that's, like, how possible do you think that is? One thing I've been fascinated by recently is we talked about these, you know, universal constants that kind of come from, you know, perhaps a great architect, like the Fibonacci sequence. One constant I've been fascinated by lately, and I've been seeing it more and more, is the tendency for everything in the universe, it seems like, to concentrate. So if you look at, like, stars in the sky, I forget the exact percentage, but I think it's 10% of the stars have 90% of the mass of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at classical music, you know, 10% of classical artists compose 90% of what we listen to, and of those songs. And it seems like more and more what I've been noticing in Freemasonry and in other volunteer organizations is, no matter how much it seems like at first everybody's on board and everybody's excited, it seems like more and more there's this concentration of the amount of work, you know, 10% of people do 90% of the work. Mm-hmm. And then those 10% get fatigued. And I've just been finding, it seems like there's a lot of concentration of responsibility over time. Do you think that that's also a natural thing, or do you think that it's possible to, that's more just a reflection of
if you time simply limitations? If you simply let an organization run on its own, yeah, you're going to find that there's hangers-on who simply want to put it on their resume, and then there's other people who wind up being very committed to it. They wind up doing the lion's share, and perhaps they become too committed to it. If you just simply let an organization run on autopilot, it'll do that. A well-run organization, I think, and I mentioned this to you before, it'll have three generations to it. Any sort of organization, but I'll pick on a business. I'll pick on my favorite masonry contractor. There's a fellow there who's president of the company. He's very capable. He's very, he knows his stuff. His dad built the company. Every now and again, he can lean on his dad for expertise and experience whenever that's necessary, but he can run this place on his own. And in back of him, there's a whole generation of younger guys than he is that he's training and grooming to come up the ladders so that they can eventually do what he does. And he can go on and be the expert with the experience. So we need to have a very healthy middle generation. Now I can speak to Freemasonry. We need to have a healthy middle generation. We certainly have got a plethora of expertise and experience that we can lean on. But the younger generation, they tend to be very eager people who want to do whatever for our organization, but they lack the skills. Perhaps they don't have the sort of time commitment that we used to. Perhaps they don't have the sort of financial capability that we used to. But we need to mentor those, this middle generation, need to mentor those younger men, so that they can eventually run a proper organization. We need to engage them. And that way it gets away from the idea of 10% of the people doing 90% of the work and remain relevant. I mean, whatever it is you do, it's got to be something that works. You know, when the Detroit Temple, let's pick on it, was built in 1920, the role of men in a family is very different then than it is now. And I think that you find a lot of our time is spent doing things that men didn't do back in the 20s. We're suddenly more active fathers, and that's seen as being a positive. That's just one example, but it's a section of time that suddenly we're not spending towards Freemasonry, at least not in a traditional sense. I think that we could probably look at it with a fair bit of intensity and find ways that No, being a good father, we can see that as being part of Freemasonry. How can we do that? And how can this organization, not necessarily a building, how can this organization work to serve us that way?
I agree 100% with that. I love professional wrestling. So one quote,
Okay.
No, but there's one quote I always liked, John Cena. He was kind of famous for being an incredibly hard worker, champion a bunch of times or whatever. But he said at one point, the reason that I was able to work so hard and do so much is because it's not about putting your life. He said it wasn't about putting my life on hold for wrestling. It was about making wrestling my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly there's an aspect of that that can be applied to Freemasonry. A lot of people.
Oh, easy.
You know, it's there needs to be at least some people who make Freemasonry their life, as opposed to this idea of putting your life on hold for it, or they don't want to do that. I've always thought, you know, there's got to be an avenue by which a certain percentage of people can become can make Masonry part of their life, or a considerable part of their life.
Making Freemasonry your life doesn't mean you're going to be spending every minute of your life in committee meetings or trying to be important, being the guy in the big chair up front. It means leading your life as a Mason. Getting back to the idea of properly built buildings are like properly built men.
I like that. I think that's a good place to end this. Because I like that. I think you're absolutely right. A properly run life is like a properly built building.
There you go.
I always forget to do this. So I'm going to do it now and remind everybody to hit the subscribe button, like, follow, all that jazz. Go to Patreon if you want to support us financially. And with that, if anybody wants to get in touch with you to either about heritage restoration projects, or if they have questions, whether they be with the Masonic Temple or not, how would they go about doing that?
You can post a link to my website and to my email coordinates on your website. My architectural firm here in Edmonton is Boreas Architecture. Boreas being the mythical Greek god of northern winds. Mythology, yeah, I work on old buildings. I work in northern climes, and I seem to be working in cities that are very windy at that too, be it Edmonton or Chicago. And my email address, dbabak@boreasarchitecture.ca. Looking forward to hearing from everyone.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And all the best in Edmonton. I know you got your first snowfall yesterday, so.
Yep. Yeah.
Good luck. Good luck surviving winter.
Okay.